This is the current federal tax developments for the week of April the 3rd, 2017. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CP, a division of the Lascauzo Institute, and your state society of CPAs. This week, we're going to discover issues that arise as FASB and the IRC start looking at dealing with accounting. We'll talk about how we're going to interact, how we're going to make those things all work together, crossing over into the ANA just a little bit. We're going to talk about also this. We're going to take a look at some guidance that's issued on payroll tax version of the research credit. Time's coming up to file 941, so IRS had to get this out. The tax court denied a deduction to a management fee paid to a related party. We'll talk about how that worked. And we'll take a look at the 27 vehicle depreciation limits and lease inclusion tables that came out this week from the IRS. Well, as I said, to give you a little repetition from last week, because, you know, at this time of year, it's easy to forget things. But those of you, I want to remind you, those of you in Oregon, we've got some May CPE coming up. And yes, believe it or not, it's only a month and a half away when we're going to be doing that sort of thing. So CPE is going to get started here shortly now that we're getting toward the end of tax season, right? It's April, if you haven't noticed. That didn't trip on you that we're into April now, and we are now sitting shortly. We are just over 2 weeks away from the filing deadline this year of the 18th. But I'll be 2 days up in Oregon in May. On May 17th, I'll be doing an estate course. It'll talk about assisting the survivors of the decedent's estate, and we'll specifically deal with the Oregon estate tax as part of that, as well as the Oregon Principal and Income Act. And we'll take a look on May 18th for real estate partnerships, getting in, getting out, and getting taxed. We'll talk about the interaction of partnership rules, which, by the way, as we all know, are subject to change on the exam front in the next year. And we'll take a look at that combined with real estate. And as we all were aware, under the capitalization rules, there were a lot of significant issues that have impacted us in the area of real estate. So we're going to take a look at those two combined areas. You can sign up for these courses, which will be given in the Portland, Oregon area. If you go to the Oregon Society's website, that's at www.orcpa.org. And sign up for those courses, again, coming up in the middle of May. Well, let's take a look at our developments this week. We're going to start off with an IRS notice. This is notice 2017-23. And this is where the IRS has issued interim guidance on the payroll tax research credit option. You may remember, as part of the Protecting America for Tax Hikes Act of 2015, Congress decided to allow businesses that qualify, certain small businesses qualifying for the research credit, to instead of taking that credit against income taxes, which if they're a small startup, they might not have any, and rather allow them to use that credit to offset the employer FICA that's being paid on payroll tax reports. And obviously, if they have employees, they're going to have employer FICA. So the idea is that this gets some money to them in the early phases of operation when the organization very, very well not have net income and therefore not be able to make much use of a net income tax credit. This all starts, so this is the first you're going to be doing it because we're going to have to elect to apply that research credit we qualified for on our 16 returns and decide to use that against our payroll taxes. And obviously, the first quarter 941s are coming up here shortly. So we now have guidance on how to deal with this. Now remember, a qualifying small business that can make this election has to meet a few criteria. First thing is it has to have gross receipts for the taxable year of less than $5 million. That's determined under the rules of Section 448. And then the entity cannot have had gross receipts for any taxable year preceding the five tax year period ending with such taxable year. So effectively, once you start having gross receipts, you can't take this credit after the fifth year of gross receipts. The credit is capped at $250,000 for any payroll tax election. Now, this ruling goes into some rules. First thing is it gives you some clarifying examples, which you can find reproduced in our materials this week, that discuss how you deal with the $5 million limit where you may have related entities. Because again, we have related entities, we do have to combine for this purpose, and you have to combine using, you know, basically using controlled group style rules. They're going to talk here about how you determine if you have the gross receipts, if you meet the requirement for these particular rules to be a qualifying corporation or qualifying entity. We also have to make the election. And the ruling tells us that we make the election by completing Form 6765, which is credit for increasing research activities relating to the payroll tax credit election, and attach that to your timely filed return for the taxable year to which the election applies. So you have to have a timely filed 2016 return. You have to attach the election to that return. And it has to be, as we said, the timely filed structure. So late returns, you're stuck with it on the income tax return. But if you timely filed, you can do this. Now, if a qualified small business timely files its return for beginning after 2015, but fails to make the election, you can make the election on an amended return filed on or before December 31st, 2017. So this gives you an out for those who might have filed their return, just now realize they have this option. They can go back and fix it as long as they do so by the end of this year. The notice tells you how to file that amended return, how you have to put notices on it. They'll say it's filed pursuant to notice 2017-23, and attach a statement reflecting the election that's being made. Now, as we said, the credit is limited to your qualified research credit for the taxable year, $250,000, or a qualified small business other than a partnership S corporation, the amount of the qualified small business credit carried forward under Section 39 carried from the taxable year before the application of Section 41A. Now, no election is available if you made an election for five or more preceding tax years. So even if you had no, let's say you've gone for 10 years with no gross receipts, hopefully you had lots of capital to come in, but you had no gross receipts for 10 years, you're going to lose this election. You know, you've only got 5 years of those 10 years you can make this election to use it to recover your payroll taxes. Section 4.06 of this notice will walk you through what's going to be crucial at this point. How in the world do you claim this on the actual payroll tax returns? And essentially, you're going to claim it on the 941 that you're filing now in accordance with the requirement section 4.06. This is interim guidance. The IRS at the very end asked for additional guidance that may be necessary as they move toward permanent guidance. Now, how quickly that permanent guidance comes is a little more open to question. Because what the IRS is doing now, the commissioner had said at the beginning of last week, Tax Notes reported, that the IRS is going to begin issuing and has begun, this is part of it, what the commissioner referred to as sub-regulatory guidance. That is guidance that does not rise to the level of regulation. The IRS is still not releasing proposed regulations or temporary or final regulations because they're still processing what the, you know, kill two regulations for every one new one issued, how that impacts the IRS if it does, and how they're going to deal with that. So we're still at a position of not seeing regulations come out yet. That, you know, anything at the regulatory level is still on hold, but we are seeing these sub-regulatory level guidance. And I have a feeling what's going to be happening is we're going to see a lot more of these notices that are going to effectively, you know, instead of issuing a regulation to deal with the issue, they'll issue a bunch of notices or announcements. And we may see that go on at least till such time that we get clarity about how this two-for-one rule is going to be handled with regard to the IRS. Next up, we have a tax court case. So let's take a look here. This is the case of Home Team Transition Management versus Commissioner. This is TC Memo 2017-51. This case came down on March the 28th. And what this case dealt with in March, this case dealt with the issue of a taxpayer who had two related corporations. And for various reasons, we get taxpayers with this structure. You know, where the taxpayer has set up two related entities. In this case, we had a holding company, Sacer Core Enterprises, and we had a subsidiary, that's an operating business, Home Team Transition Management, which was the defendant in this case. Now, Sacer Core was a Missouri for-profit corporation that was incorporated by the shareholders, and they were held in equal percentages by four shareholders. The intention was to acquire in-home healthcare companies, but for the years in question, the only company they had actually been operating was this Home Team Transition Management, which they had previously owned and then had acquired from someone else previously. Now, the corporation claimed deductions in the 3 years in question for management fees of $120,000, $36,000, and $42,000. In each year, what happened was Home Team had transferred funds during the year to Safer Core as it had cash available to transfers. And on the books, those transfers were initially recorded as loans to Safer Core. At the end of the year, some or all of the loans were reclassified as management fees. The IRS was saying, we don't buy the idea that there's any management fees here, that there was any service provided by Safer Core to Home Team, to Home Team Transition Management, the subsidiary. One of the problems we had was that the fees were based solely on Home Team's ability to pay, rather than being payments for things that were invoiced to Safer Core or under the terms of a contract, you know, a payment per month for these things. The parent also had no employees. So that raises the obvious question of how could it be providing management services if it had no resources with which to provide the services? Okay. Now, some of the Safer Core employee shareholders were employees. Two of the four were employees of Home Team, and they were paid a salary by that organization. The court also noted that nowhere here did we ever get any evidence of what exactly Safer Core did for the sub. To be able to claim a deduction for fees, there are a few things we have to meet. First thing is, under 162, you've got to show that the payments were for services actually performed. The services represented ordinary necessary expenses of the business that is claiming the deduction, and the payments were reasonable for the services involved. The court naturally is skeptical when the payment is going to a related party. And the problem in this case was that the subsidiary, you know, the parent, or I should say the sub, failed to show any of these justifications for what it paid the parent. Now, that doesn't mean you can't pay a related party. You may remember that we talked back in May of last year about the case of H.W. Johnson, Inc. versus Commissioner, TC Memo 2016-95. If you go back and take a look at that case, you'll discover there that a payment to a related company was found to be fully justified by the court. But in that case, there were solid business reasons why we had this other entity. If you don't remember that case, it was a case where a mom and her two sons were owners of the corporation. The sons said, to survive, we really need to get a supplier. We need to get control of suppliers because we're having trouble getting supplies, you know, getting materials for our business. Mom didn't want to take the risk. So the sons formed this partnership, which they went out and essentially got control of a related of, you know, suppliers. So they would have a supply of this. And then they were paid by the company fees for, you know, related to management and issues related down that area. In that case, the tax court found that, in fact, there was a real business purpose. Mom did not want to be involved in this. The payments to that entity gave real value because it assured a ready supply of materials to the company that was paying the fee. And so the court found that was fine. The problem in Home Team is very simple. There's a few of them. Number one, there was no obvious agreement as to what they were paying for. Number two, no third party would reasonably have accepted an agreement where we just pay you whatever we have available to pay you. Well, if you take whatever is available to pay you, you know, the free cash goes to you, that looks a lot more like what an owner gets than what a service provider gets. Also, there's that problem that they originally booked all of these as loans and then after the fact decided to journal entry their way over to make these into some sort of deductible expense. That also doesn't go over well. You know, be careful here. If your clients are working with have related entities and you are making transfers between the two, you want to make sure you're not exposed to the problem we see here. And you want to review this case, review the case of Johnson versus Commissioner, H.W. Johnson, Inc. versus Commissioner. And you'll see the differences as to why for the Johnson case, it all works, and why for Home Team, it doesn't work at all. Next up, this is fairly simple. The IRS has released the depreciation numbers for 2017 for automobiles, or what most of us in the vernacular refer to as luxury auto limitations, though I realize it's not much of a luxury. We have four tables that are issued like every year, and they really have not changed drastically. There are very, very, very minor changes based on inflation. Table one is the limits for passenger automobiles that are first placed in service in 17 and which you claim bonus depreciation on. Table two is for trucks and vans for which bonus depreciation is claimed. Table 3 is for, again, back to automobiles with no bonus, and Table 4 is for trucks and vans with no bonus. Now, please remember, these are the, quote, luxury auto limitations. These are gotten around if you have the gross vehicle weight in excess of 6,000 pounds. So if you're looking for a large SUV, you can get around this limit. Also, remember, these limits apply to both depreciation and Section 179. So you can't get around these rules by taking a 179 deduction. This revenue procedure also has the updated tables to be used for the lease inclusion amount that you're going to add back this year if you are leasing automobiles that would be subject to these rules. Those lease inclusion numbers, the updated numbers, they're in the tables. We do have the initial four tables are in our materials for this week. The full lease inclusion tables aren't there, but they're in the rev proc that we link to. So if you need to use those, just go pick those up there. Now, finally, we go to our lead issue for this week, and that is the IRS has issued a proposed revenue procedure dealing with FASB's new revenue recognition standard. Now, for those of you that may have been paying attention to GAAP issues, you know, you've been had your head buried down in taxes for the last 5 years and hadn't paid any attention to anything going on over on the GAAP side of the equation, you may not be aware that there is a major change that is coming down the pike from FASB, which is a new standard entitled Revenue from Contracts with Customers. That's a FASB Accounting Standards Update 2014-09. This is going to deal with changes in how companies recognize revenue under financial account for financial accounting purposes. Now, those of us in tax realize there's a couple of things at play here. We're talking about, primarily in this case, FASB is going to change the timing of recognition. Now, timing of recognition of an item under tax is what we know of as an accounting method, which isn't really just mean something FASB touches, but it means something that affects the timing, but not the amount of an item of income or deduction. So we'll eventually get the same revenue, but we may record it in different years. We're also aware that whenever we change an accounting method, we have to get the IRS's permission to make the change under 446. And that permission to change, if we're going to change our method, that method must be one that is allowed under Internal Revenue Section 451 that deals with when we recognize revenue for tax purposes. So the new FASB is likely going to change when income is booked for financial statement purposes. Now that raises a whole bunch of issues because companies would probably like to book their revenue for taxes as closely as they can to their book, you know, to what they're showing on the financials just for simplicity. So this may lead to a bunch of problems where we may see changes. We also have things like when you get prepayments for services, we have special accounting methods for taxes that have previously said you can recognize, you know, you can defer recognition, but you can only defer so much as you've not already recognized on your financial statement. Now you might think, well, that's no big deal. We keep doing that. If we change our financial statement recognition, that would just be, we just, you know, put the new number on the tax return. You can't do that. If you change your method of financial statement recognition, the IRS has ruled that's going to be a tax method change because you change the underlying way you're computing what's included. And so you're still going to need permission to make that change. So now we're going to deal with this problem that's coming up. The IRS had previously asked for guidance in Notice 2015-40, and it asked on the following issues. To what extent would using the new standard for income tax purposes result in acceleration deferral of income under 451 or other provisions of the code? What industry and or transaction-specific issues might arise as well as the new standard that may need to be addressed in future guidance? To what extent do the new standards deviate from the requirements of 451? In what situations should the IRS allow taxpayers to adopt standards that follow their book method of accounting for tax purposes? For example, would it be okay if income is accelerated so it's recognized faster than 451 would require? And to what extent do the rules regarding allocation of standalone sales price and transaction price new standard affects the taxpayer's ability to satisfy their tax obligations? And in a very broad sense, you know, we have this recognition rule that we have there. You know, 451A provides that any item of gross income must be included in gross income the year in which it was received by the taxpayer, unless it is includable in a different year, pursuant to the taxpayer's method of accounting. And the new revenue recognition standards, you know, are going to potentially make some changes there. And they're coming up relatively quick for those of you who aren't aware. For publicly traded entities, certain not-for-profit entities and certain employee benefit plans, and reporting periods beginning after December 15th, 2017. So that means next year's calendar year statements would be affected. For non-public companies, right, we get 2018 is the date. So 2019 will be able to come in. Early adoption is allowed for reporting periods that begin after the end of 16. So you could be using it this year. That was found in FASB update 2015-14, which deferred the effective dates. Now, what the IRS comes with this rule, it says, okay, we're going to have to deal with this and really break it down to a couple of sections. First, they say, okay, we want to change, we're now reviewing our accounting method. And by the way, we may discover some problems with our accounting methods that I've been using for tax. We do this review. Remember, a lot of us discovered, you know, there were a lot of people I talked to who discovered that they'd been using the wrong depreciation methods when they went back and did the review that was necessary for changing the reporting under the 263a regulations that we talked about for capitalization rules. Remember all that fun we had a couple of years ago? Well, you're probably going to have a few of those come up in this case. Now, if you're trying to make a change that already is covered by an automatic change method, then the IRS says just follow the automatic change method found in Revenue Procedure 2015-13, or I should say 2016-29 or its successor, and use all the rules found in 2015-13 about how to put it together. Section 5.02 deals with what happens if we, you know, we're changing our recognition for FASB, and we discover that pursuant to that, we'd like to change how we're reporting things on the tax return, because we may have previously been reporting on the tax return the way we did for GAAP. And we'd like to go with GAAP, and the new way GAAP record really does still comply with 451, but there is no automatic change to allow us to modify the way we're going to recognize, like what's a contract and how we recognize the income and when it's recognized. So there's no automatic change available. In this case, the IRS is going to allow temporarily an automatic change option for a qualified same year method change. That's a change that happens essentially in the year in which you are going to be converting. You know, you're going to be changing over for FASB. That year is the one that will work. If you're doing that, you'll file a Form 3115. You're going to check the box for line 1B and write Revenue Procedure 2017-whatever this number ends up being, followed by the applicable income provision of the code or income regulations or the applicant relevant guidance that allow you to do it this way, and then have a brief description of the change. Now, one big advantage that we're going to have here is the IRS will allow us to make multiple changes on the same 3115 if it all relates to this FASB issue. That's going to be very helpful because we may have multiple things we need to change. And if we had to do 32 different 3115s, that'd get a little tedious. Now, normally when you make a change of accounting method, the taxpayer is required to account for the cumulative change under the rules of 41A. Normally under 41A, and by the way, the procedure is not totally clear that we're going to get the spread, but normally we get the entire change in the year of change if the cumulative effect is negative or if it's positive and less than $50,000, we elect to recognize the adjustment in 1 year or recognize evenly over 4 years, including the year of change otherwise. However, the procedures will, now they say the taxpayer may make the change on a cutoff basis for certain small trades or businesses. Now, to qualify for cutoff means we don't go back and restate as if we'd always been doing it this way, but we just start doing it on new things. You must have one or more distinct trades or businesses that have total assets of less than $10 million as the first day of the tax period for which a change is requested, or annual gross receipts of $10 million or less. This is very similar to the relief we got under the capitalization and repair regs, the cutoff test for small business, except we don't have an exemption here of not having to file 3115. We still have to file it. Now, the one problem, though, is while it starts out and says we may make the change on a cutoff basis, the ruling goes on to say a 41A adjustment is neither permitted nor required for such separate or distinct trade or business. Now, that suggests that potentially there is no election that you would have to do it on a cutoff basis if you are a small business. Hopefully, the IRS will clarify whether the May controls or whether the second clause that says it's not permitted controls for this purposes. From a practical standpoint, that's mainly going to affect you. This taxpayer has the same effect as 41A adjustment taking place entirely in the year of change for most taxpayers, unless you have items that would go beyond 1 year that would still be outstanding at the end of the following year. Most of these things would clear up. Now, one key takeaway for right now, please remember, the mere fact that FASB is requiring you to change how you report an item in income, the IRS is not conceding at this point. Remember, they're still asking for guidance. They're not conceding they will allow you to use the FASB method. Rather, this proposed revenue procedure merely says if FASB's method complies with the requirements for 451, which means the standard tax rules we've all used for years, then you can make the change under this. But if it doesn't, merely the fact that FASB wants it reported this way does not mean you're going to be able to report it that way for tax purposes. So be aware of that. A lot of companies now are working up on what's going to happen with the revenue recognition change. I would suggest this proposed revenue procedure tells us to at least start thinking about, are we going to want to make tax changes? And specifically, at least for right now, will there be tax changes where we can justify the Section 451 is not violated if we change from how we used to record it on the books for GAAP to how we record it now, if we want to try to keep that in line for tax purposes? So be aware, watch for follow-up guidance, and specifically watch in the follow-up guidance whether the service does broaden it. Let's say, like that example says, if you accelerate, we're okay. Do they add provisions like that to the final note, to the final revenue procedure, or do they even issue that in other guidance like notices? Well, we've made it to April. You may remember that. And of course, we know that whole thing, the April showers, May flowers, whole routine. All of us kind of hope the rain, most of us probably hoping the rain occurs the first 2 weeks because we're not going to see it. We won't be outside. Have a good time here as we close up with the tax season. Take care. Be sure to be watching here in the middle of the month. Most of the state society is going to get their catalogs out here in April. And so it'll be time coming up now to start doing all that fun planning for your CPE year. So just a reminder, that's going to be coming up here shortly. So think about your state societies and think about the type of education and type of things you should be thinking about being trained on for this year. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of April the 3rd, 2017. Current Federal Tax Developments, again, brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPE, Incorporated, Division of the Scalzo Institute, and your state society of CPAs. You can catch our current daily updates at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you have any questions or comments, you can email me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, and you can follow me on Twitter, where we'll post normally or do new articles. Be online. It'll be at edzollers is the Twitter handle to follow. And take care. Don't work too hard over the next couple of weeks, and we'll hopefully see you next time here on Current Federal Tax Developments.